Good evening and welcome to the December 19th, 2006 meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board met in closed session and we discussed pending litigation, San Luis Coastal Unified School District versus J.H. Edwards Company regarding Sunnyside tenancy. We also talked about status of negotiations with California School Employees Association, San Luis Coastal Teachers Association, and Service Employees International Union. Pardon me. Do we have a consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Okay. Let's move toward then the action on approval of the minutes. Do I hear a motion?
I make a motion to approve the minutes of both meetings.
Are those the minutes as corrected?
What's the catch on this?
The downside is that under item number 15, it looks like the underlined word is, the downside is that failure means the student has 4 years of PE requirements rather than two.
That's not a correction. The correction is merely that the center item on that page, item 15,
yes.
On the original minutes you received, did not have a number assigned to it. It wasn't identified as a heading. So I just needed to add that, and it affected the numbering from there forward in the rest of the document.
Okay.
It's about the SLO County School Boards Association and voting delegate, and it mentions Marilyn Roger as an alternate.
That's an error.
That's an error. It was Mark Buckman, but I would maybe bring up an advanced agenda because you didn't, you know, I think that would be great if you were, and Mark has another job. But we have to do it. We have to put it on advance agenda to change it.
So it would stay as it is. It would stand as it is.
Yeah. If we leave this, then it just changes the past. Rewrite history. No.
Well, the action that was taken by the board stands on its own. It's conforming the minutes to the action that was taken by the board.
See, I don't think the minutes do conform. That's my point.
Then they should be amended. And I congratulate you and appreciate you doing it.
So would you like to amend the minutes to reflect what actually happened in the board meeting? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I think that's what we have to do. But okay. I'm going to bring up that I think I like the minutes the way they're written, so maybe we'll change it.
Okay, so
I'd have to do an advance agenda, though, right?
If we want to appoint,
if it's okay with Mark.
Mark as the alternate representative instead of Marilyn as the alternate representative?
Well, that's what happened.
Okay.
The only thing I might add in here is that this isn't agendized to change the
right.
board's action, so you would have to agendize it.
Yeah, I just need a reminder as to what did I agree to.
Can I just say real quick?
Sure.
The minutes should read that the alternate is Mark. So that's what we're going to change. And if we want to have, I would like to have you be it as the minutes read, but that would have to be a future agenda item.
Yes, that's correct.
So the question is then, do we approve the minutes as they are amended, corrected, and then for an advanced agenda item, revisit the notion of San Luis County School Boards Association voting membership and discuss who would be the alternate member if Marilyn is not the alternate member.
Well, she's not right now.
Mr. President?
Yes, ma'am.
If I could just point out to you, the bylaws for the County School Boards Association only allow for one voting member. So an alternate is really a convenience if Adrian can't attend those meetings, but an alternate would not have a voting authority.
Right?
Maryland.
Or ask Mark to do it.
I'm thoroughly confused.
Well, I'll make a new motion to approve the minutes with the correction.
I appreciate that Adrian would like me to do that, and I have signed up for any number of other things, but that's not something that I have interest in signing up for at this time. But thank you.
All The board did receive a letter from Gene Knox regarding planning for enrollment growth. The board also received an anonymous letter, which was forwarded to the superintendent. Okay, let's move on to public comment. We have several people who wish to speak. If you'd like to speak right now during public comment, you can do that. If you'd rather wait for a specific agenda item, we're happy to have you wait for a specific agenda item. If you'd like to speak now in public comment, could you just come on forward?
Would you want to call Bruce first?
I don't know. Is this
there's a name.
Bruce, are you going to be speaking for... I'm sorry?
I'm Bruce Tadone. I teach chemistry at San Luis High School.
The question is, do you want to talk now or do you want to wait till...
I'll just soon do it now.
Sure, absolutely.
I have to be at work in the morning after working all day, so I have a second job on top of all this, but I don't sound like it. There we go. All right. It's me. Really me. Anyway. Well, thank you for letting me address what I think is a very important issue, this issue of academic freedom. From the perspective of a veteran of 3 decades of teaching, I can tell you this is a serious issue. If you want to improve teaching and you want to improve education, the first thing you have to have is smart teachers. You won't have them if they're going to be constantly monitored by the standards Nazis. Smart kids are not going to enter a profession where they're handed a script of what to teach and when to teach it and how to do it. My daughter is a third year at UC San Diego, and that's the way they teach in San Diego, and that's the way she's being instructed. Here's the script. You follow it. She's not real excited about the profession right now, and I don't blame her. She's a smart kid. She should be in the profession. Remember that one? If the trustees of San Luis Coastal Unified School District are serious about improving education, the first thing we should do is mail the STAR test back to Sacramento. You could tell them that we are accountable to our kids. We measure how they're doing in college and beyond. The numbers are available to you. You would take some heat. You might even appear on Bill O'Reilly. You might even have to appear on a few more talk shows. But you know what? You'd survive, and you'd be right. I'm reminded of two, you may think the idea is crazy, but I'm reminded a dozen years ago there were two doctors who had a crazy idea in San Luis Obispo. Let's eliminate smoking from all public places. They were ridiculed, they were called all kinds of bad names, and they were told what a rotten idea that was. But you know what? It took off here. It took off around the county, eventually the state and the country, and now it's around the world. You can do it too. You can have the same courage those two doctors had. It's in your hands. Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to address the board right now during public comment? Dr. Hollifield.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joseph Hollifield. I'm I've been here in the community. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been a school psychologist a few years ago with San Luis Coastal and been around with several other districts. But I'm also coming as a parent and just a concerned community person. It's in regards to Pacheco School, and obviously I'm probably going to try to enroll my daughter. She's 4 and a half into the program, and I think it's a great opportunity. Just some concerns that I have is that several of my friends have had their children not have that opportunity again. They've enrolled and they didn't get into the program for some reason or another. They wanted their children to be in the dual immersion program. And I kind of see it as my concern is that here's an opportunity for the families, for the kids who want that skill, who want that particular skill, either for cultural reasons or for just to have their children have the experience. And it's also an opportunity for the district in itself to have, you know, a program that people want to get into. And for them not to be able to get into that, I think it's kind of, that probably needs to be re-explored as to why that is. And I guess I'm just kind of coming as food for thought or kind of to lay a seed or so forth is to explore really of those kids that are that aren't getting in, where are they in the district? Where are they coming from? Are they coastal kids? Are the kids that, I mean, how many, what's the data on the kids that are currently in the program? Where are they from? Are they from the coast? Is it something that, you know, the district can explore as possibly multilingual and it creates more economic opportunities for our kids in the community as well as kids who may come back here professionally to work in the community? Because I know as a clinical director and with the clinic and the program, we can't find bilingual professionals to service the community. So, I mean, we're talking about long-term job opportunities for our kids. And so that's what I wanted to address tonight, and just open it up and just see if there's something that can be explored or discussed at a future meeting or so forth. So thank you.
Thanks, Joe. And what the board would do is, if this is something the board has an interest in exploring further, we would come back at advanced agenda items, and okay. We would discuss it toward the end of the meeting.
Okay. Okay. Great.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the board now during public comment? Okay, seeing no one. Let's move on then to reports. We do not have any student members here this evening. Do we have any staff that would like to make a report this evening? Okay, seeing none. Mr. Miller, status of the state budget.
I don't have anything at this time, Mr. President.
All right, then let's move on to item number 3, which is an offer of district land for sale to the general public, the old Fairview School site, resolution 070607. Mr. Parker.
This is the next step in the rather lengthy process of disposition and sale of district-owned or public-owned properties. Just to recap, we went through community meetings about and sought input from the community as to what we should do with the property. We brought that to the board. The board said, well, let's move forward with the sale process. We notified certain public agencies per Ed Code. None of the public agencies notified have expressed an interest in the property, and that time frame has lapsed. And now, if the board chooses to pass this resolution, we would make official notice to the general public that the property is for sale, and we would attempt to sell it as is detailed in the item.
Move approval of resolution 070607.
It's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Peter. Is there any discussion on this item? Okay, seeing none, Mrs. Holmes? Is there any public comment? I'm sorry, I didn't see anybody there. Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mr. Peter?
Aye.
Mrs. Dickinson?
Yes.
Mr. Spadafore?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Counselors to our ranks and improve the ratio, student-to-teacher ratio, to approximately 300-1 in grades 7 through 12. You also received a draft of the board policy, which complements this supplemental program. They ask us to have a board policy that reflects the changes, including the supplemental program. So before you are the proposed revisions to our board policy 6164.2. And we'd ask that you take some time tonight to take a look at this, at these changes. If I might highlight the fact that really the addition highlights our academic career counseling commitment, as well as the supplemental school counseling program, the requirement for personal counseling, and also crisis counseling. I've included our administrative regulations, which are the requirements that we must follow that are for the purposes of the administrative staff to follow. But your job is to review your board policy and make any suggestions, revisions that you deem necessary. Thank you.
Mr. Spadafore and then Mr. Millar.
Thank you. Dr. Matakovich, just a couple questions about this. The policies are comprehensive and cover a lot of programs and interventions. I had two questions. Do the counseling, the counselors have an opportunity to meet together to discuss particular cases or situations where they may be able to develop or come up with ideas, approaches? Is there any type of teamwork relative to the counselors?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. We meet with our counseling staff in joint counselor meetings monthly, as well as secondary counselor meetings monthly. So we have an opportunity to review procedures and share case studies and all of that. And as a result of this policy, it'll be our responsibility to come up with a reporting mechanism to you and to the state and to agree to our approach in terms of how to address these additional requirements.
So the steps that are outlined here can form, or do they form, kind of a checklist to determine if everything has been done that could be done for a student who may need these?
I'm confident that I understood, and I want to ask you just to kind of summarize it for me. I don't want to put you on the spot for a whole lot of specifics. But what are we agreeing, what additional burdens are we agreeing to undertake in order to take advantage of this program? Because I know we're already doing counseling. I know we already have an emergency response protocol that involves counseling, emergency counseling. What new things are we taking on to participate in this program?
Well, as you read in the administrative regulations, it indicates that we're required in grades 7, 10, and 12 to commit to a parent conference that reviews the student's academic profile as well as provides interventions and career technical ed support as well as college information. So we're committing to provide that to all of our families.
And is that something at that grade level we were not providing previously?
We offer it, and those families that take advantage of it certainly can participate, but I think the commitment here is that all families will participate in this program, so it'll be our job to work with our families to ensure that they're able to we'll be adjusting our calendars to ensure that we're able to meet this conference schedule.
In the interest of time, is it fair to say that we're essentially going to continue doing the same things that we've been doing, but we've made a greater commitment to provide the services to all students?
And we have made that commitment to all students and all families, if asked, but we will be initiating requests formally to families to ensure that those, particularly those at risk, are participating with us in this conference schedule.
Thank you.
Well, I remember when we talked about, you know, how neat it would be if we could have sort of an IEP model where all students get to sit down with a counselor and develop sort of an individual plan. And this gives us the resources to approach that,
yes,
which is really nice. Mm-hmm. It's great. So I think it's wonderful that we are doing this. I had a question that came up at one of our expulsion hearings about a particular, you know, what might be a trigger. I mean, let's say you're not in 7th grade or 10th grade, you know, and there's all these between months that you're going to meet. But off that schedule, you know, is there a trigger that would set up an SST, a student study team? I think in this district,
the counselors have worked on what we call a standards-based guidance and counseling program, and we want to ensure that all kids have access to services. So K through 12, we're making a commitment to ensure that our kids aren't missed, and so our counselors are committed to making this happen. So I think out of this program, we'll identify the characteristics that we'll need to look for and to ensure that our students are provided the support they need in order to be successful.
Thanks for all your work on this. I had one more question. This is a little bit different, but right in the middle of the blue page, it says colleges, employers, and prospective employers, including military services representatives, shall have access to students for recruiting purposes unless parent guardian withholds permission for such access. This is nothing new. I mean, that's just the standard language that we've had. But I just want to remind parents they can opt out of that. But don't you think we could define the word access in terms of, like, military recruiters, for instance, having access to students? Does that mean during class, during lunch, or just their phone numbers? I don't know.
It's not defined, but certainly that they have the ability to, parents have the ability to, you know, give permission for this access for college recruiters as well as military recruiters.
I'm curious if, I know it's required by No Child Left Behind, but can a district give the addresses and phone numbers of students whose parents have not objected, and that be it? Can they say, you know, you can't come into classrooms? Do they have the power to do that?
If I could, okay. I think we have to allow the same kind of access to military recruiters that we do to job recruiters and to college recruiters. So I think whatever restrictions we put on the one, we'd probably have to put on everyone.
My question was about the military recruiters as well. But is this the only place where a parent can become aware of this opt-out? In other words, they have to go through the board policies, or is there some other place that this is made available?
In our registration information, it's very specific as far as that access or that permission that a parent must give. They have to sign in order to...
specific and information to parents... letting them know that they can opt out.
Yes.
And so this is not something that the board had. The board has directed the school district to make it plain to parents that they can opt out mm-hmm. in their registration materials.
It's in the registration.
Just a couple things. Thank you. The courts have held that any institution of any educational institution that receives public funding has to make the school available during regular school hours mm-hmm. to recruiters and others who have access, but a parent signing the request not to have their child involved, then the student would not be there. Mm-hmm. And that's what the court had said also, that a parent has the choice to ask that the student not be present during those occasions. And then my last request was, when the protocols are developed, mm-hmm. could that be included in a Friday packet?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Other questions or comments from board members? And does anybody from the public wish to speak to this? Judy.
Judy Newhouser. I'm a parent of a high school student at Los Osos. I just wanted to make sure that I know some districts have had the form be if you opt out of releasing phone number, it's been opting out of releasing phone number for everything, colleges, mm-hmm. universities, and military. And I know so far it's been separated, and I want to make sure that stays separated.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Great.
That's correct.
Mr. Bedrigan.
As a parent of a high school student whose junior year, there is something in the registration packet. I'd like to see it be more clear. It's just one little tiny line. It's easy to miss. I've learned that for the recruiters, one of the protocols that they follow is that once they do make a contact with the home and the parent or student says, no, I'm not interested, they have to call five times. They have to be denied five times. That's their directive, that they have to follow that protocol. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, too, and the board should know about that.
I know of one parent who immediately blocked the phone numbers of all the military recruiters in the county, and it was very effective.
Mr. Buckman, and seconded by? By Mrs. Roger. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. Let's move on to item number 5, approval to lease broadband capacity to Clearwire LLC. Mr. Miller.
Thank you. At the last board meeting, staff presented background information and a proposed lease with Clearwire LLC to the board. There were two additional related agreements also presented at that time. Additional time for further development of more in-depth information was requested by the board. Board member Peter has done that investigation. And at this time, staff would recommend the Board of Education approve the First Amendment to Contingent Capacity Lease Agreement with Clearwire dated October 20th, 2006, and related documents with ZTARC Wireless.
Mic's down. Okay. One of the things we talked about at the last meeting was just getting a little bit more background about Clearwire and who they are and what they do and what their business is. And then I have some questions actually about the agreements too. So, but let me give the background first, just sort of in layman's terms if I can. Clearwire is in the business of providing WiMAX internet access services and telephony services, and they intend to roll that out across the country. And the best analogy that I could think of was, 25 years ago, we all had telephones in our homes that were connected. via telephone line. And that's sort of analogous to telephone-based or internet access that we all had 10 years ago or so, or was available 10 years ago. And then phones started popping up that utilized frequencies, the 2.4 gigahertz frequency and then the 5.8 gigahertz frequency that didn't require a line to be connected. So you could walk around your home or you could go outside your home and still talk on the telephone. And those worked within a radius of, say, 100 feet or 200 feet of the base station. And that's what many people now have in their homes with wireless base stations. I have one in my house. From my house, I can detect six other neighbors who have wireless, you know, hubs in their homes as well. And virtually any Starbucks or airports across the country has wireless access, and that's referred to as Wi-Fi now. And then the next wave for us was cell phones, where we became untethered from the line and a base station, and we can virtually take our cell phones anywhere because the frequencies over which the transmission takes place are virtually across the country at this point. So Clearwire is in the business of AT&T, which became AT&T Wireless, and one of the earliest and most successful cellular phone companies or wireless phone companies. He founded Clearwire in 2003. He recently raised $1.1 billion in venture capital to fund the rollout of, I would guess, two things. One is to build the infrastructure across the country that transmits the wireless signals. And secondly, to acquire the bandwidth that they use to transmit the internet access signals. And I think that's really what we're talking about here. To the best I could find out when I was doing various internet searches, Clearwire is affiliated with one or more limited liability corporations across the country that are in the process of acquiring these leases from school districts. Now, if you spin back to the mid-90s, the FCC released what they call educational broadband services, or a specific spectrum of frequencies that can be used for this purpose. Now, the problem with that for us as a school district is that without having the funding or the ability to develop the infrastructure ourselves, we really can't take advantage of this broadband capability. So Clearwire and Sprint and other companies like them are entering into agreements with the school districts or others that have access, other government entities that have access to these frequencies, licensing them, giving them back the rights to utilize the frequencies for their own purposes, and then selling internet access. So Clearwire, assuming we follow through with this agreement, presumably would start offering internet access, wireless internet access to the community here in San Luis Obispo. If you look on their website, their prices are $30 to $50 a month in the areas that they offer the service. And over time, I would assume that would go down. The questions I have, I guess, Russell, for you are, we've already entered into an agreement at some point in the past, if I understand sort of the history and reading through these agreements. And they're a little bit confusing with all the LLCs that are listed in the sort of the preamble to the second agreement. But in 1997, we entered an agreement with Digital Wires TV, an LLC. And for many years, nothing happened, right? They didn't develop or any services around this. And then they entered an agreement in 2005 with Fixed
Structure or start any kind of an operation going. So they were in default on the lease. In the meantime, they'd gone bankrupt. The rights of or the assets of that bankrupt company were assumed by Fixed Wireless, and Fixed Wireless became a subsidiary of Clearwire. There was another player involved in this, and his name is Tyler Kratz. He's known as ZTARC, and ZTARC had the idea to terminate the lease of Clearwire for non-performance and thus make an agreement with the school districts for their frequencies.
Right.
With his intent, I can assume, only to be a developer in this field.
Right.
When Clearwire discovered that this was going to happen, and by the way, that's the agreement that I signed as your assistant superintendent for business, was to give permission to Tyler Kratz to go forward and terminate the lease for non-performance And in exchange for that, we were to receive $200,000.
And that was the agreement from March 2006?
I'm not sure of the date, but that's about right, yes. Okay. Then ZTARC did file suit to terminate the lease. Clearwire said, whoa, we want this stuff after all. They made a separate agreement with ZTARC for him to back out of the lawsuit, and they ended up paying us the money that he promised to pay, and they have a performance clause in their contract.
Okay. I was going to ask about the payments. Did we actually receive them from ZTARC?
We've received half of the money from Clearwire.
Okay. So does that mean then that the FCC actually granted the initial approval that's referred to in what section of the agreement?
I did receive a communication from the FCC about 2 weeks ago that they did approve that.
Okay. Okay, so that triggered them paying the second $95,000, and then
the first $95,000, right. And the second $100,000 will come in about a year or a year and a half, I think it is.
Okay, so under the agreement, and we have a couple of lawyers here that can probably help, but it looks to me like this thing is assignable without prior written approval to virtually anybody. Either side can do it. We can only assign it to somebody if they are licensed by the FCC, but ZTARC can assign this agreement to whomever they want.
An asset that's a business asset that they can use in their discretion. They own that right.
Okay. So part of this is an assignment. The second part of the today, what payments we would like to receive 15 years from now, or whether or not we think we have more leverage to negotiate in 15 years. And I think it's my position that shorter agreements are better, and opening up for renegotiations in 15 years is a much better position, especially if they've built out infrastructure, are selling services, and have a bunch of clients in the area. I think we're in a much better position to negotiate a better deal. It sounds like the initial $200K has already kind of been committed to and signed off on. So that would be my view, and I'd love to hear from others.
So tell me what that would look like in terms of a motion for this evening or not.
Well, Russell, what position would we be in if we just simply said we're not going to approve this agreement?
Then what you're acting upon, just to be really clear, is the board has it in front of them tonight to ratify what I had signed before. You're under no obligation one way or the other, but in the course of business, the initial signing of the agreement was purely to move forward to clear the bankrupt company and put into place a new company that was going to give us some money where the old company hadn't. And that morphed rather quickly into ZTARC's assignment of their rights to Clearwire and a movement forward. If you choose not to do this tonight, then we would be engaged in further discussions with the company. And it may result in nothing, and it may result in their acquiescence to whatever conditions you wish to place. But it is either way. They've engaged in negotiations with every school district in the county, and every school district in the county has signed the agreement. So I'm not sure that they really need our piece in order to complete their network.
Yeah, that's the piece I don't know or understand, whether or not they can actually deliver services into Morro Bay or Los Osos or San Luis, for example, without having, you know.
What they would have in our region is we wouldn't be competing with them, okay? So the infrastructure they plan on building doesn't necessarily reside in Morro Bay or Los Osos or San Luis. I don't know where it's going to be.
Right.
But the infrastructure they build will be very similar to cell towers located on a hilltop somewhere that has. There's a clause in that agreement that they were to build out infrastructure and put into operation these frequencies, and the original company never did that.
Right. There's also reference to an agreement, a December 2005 agreement. In this amendment that we haven't seen, or can you tell us what's in that? Or
it is a
It sounds like it's an assignment agreement of some sort.
It is
well.
An assignment of the original agreement, and it just recognized the successor company. I'm speaking from memory, and I hesitate to do that. But my memory says that it was wireless that was the successor agreement that we gave them a recognition of their rights to acquire the assets of the original company.
Right. Okay. And I guess my only other question is, if we chose not to approve moving forward with this amendment, and maybe this is a question for either you two guys, too, to the counselors to my left, but I don't think that would absolve ZTARC or any of their successors or assignees from paying us the money they owe us, assuming the FCC follows through and grants those licenses, correct?
I don't, you know, if we don't give them the clauses of the negotiated agreement,
yeah.
In other words, we don't give them that 15th year of known revenues, I don't think they're obligated to pay us because that's a clause that we would be violating.
Well, they don't have that clause, though, in their existing agreement now. They're asking for it as part of the assignment.
Yes, but the initial agreement would be Clearwire. Clearwire would just void the initial agreement here next year, actually. And we could enforce a cancellation of the lease because of non-performance, but I don't think it entitles us to any money. And we weren't getting $200,000. We were only getting, I don't remember, but it was a nominal amount of money from the 1997 agreement.
Right, but we have a signed agreement with ZTARC that they'll pay us $200,000. Assuming a certain set of conditions are met. And we've met the first two of those already, and we're waiting for the third one to occur, and we collect our $100,000. That's the way I read the original agreement. The second agreement assigns the rights to Clearwire and puts this amendment in place that locks in payments from them in years 15 through...
86.
Yeah.
About real property, which is our ownership of the bandwidth. So would this not become a closed session item?
Could be.
Well, should I? I just want to make sure that I'm right. The schedule of payments on page 5.21 of the board materials is actually the payments that begin after the first 15 years. It's not payments that occur right after this agreement takes place. So I guess the one area that I would think we should explore or change, and I think it'll get to your concern, Dave, even though it is 15 years out, is that can we get some language that gives us some negotiating right at this renewal of the agreement after 15 years?
We can try anything that you want me to try. I mean...
Well, can you clarify that, though? Because the $200,000 initial payments are already in escrow.
Mm-hmm.
That's committed to. You're talking about 15 years out.
Right. This schedule, it's
on page 6.
On page 6.
Okay.
Basically is the payment schedule after the lessee decides to renew the agreement and after the initial period. Well, the initial period is 15 years.
Right.
So this is like year 16 or year 17 to 20, they're going to pay us $42,000. You know, well, first of all, $42,000, I mean, can't we even put in language to correct for inflation or to, you know, make it $2,006 or something?
I think we're in a better position if we just say, let's come to the table and negotiate.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know whether that should, I mean, if I were negotiating for them, I would... be thinking, oh, great, we're going to have this investment in the infrastructure, and now we're going to have to sit down at a bargaining table with these guys, and they've got us by the in a disadvantaged position. And
that's
so
the idea.
Yeah. So, and I don't know that if we can have some open language or language that will give us a right to negotiate that subsequent schedule of payments after if they renew from the initial period. I think that might help it. Also, if we don't buy in and we end up being a gap in their service network, aren't we in a more advantageous bargaining position should they have to come back to us?
I don't know. You know, in the conversations and meetings that I attended, it's clear that this, what I hesitate about is that I don't know if there's any other players here. I don't know if they really care if we're part of the agreement or not. And I'm not sure that if I tell them we want to change some of these things, that they're willing to come back and deal with it. And maybe that's not important. I mean, this isn't the kind of survival agreement that we need to negotiate. But I just want to understood that if we do go back, we may not have anything at the end of the conversation, which...
Well, I think they're still obligated to perform under the original agreement.
I know, but I don't know that they are or not. I have to. That's such a deep legal thing because of the interconnections, like you were talking about, of all the LLCs. I have no idea where it begins and ends in terms of continuing somebody's involvement in an agreement if the end result doesn't happen. Yeah. I don't know.
Mrs. Dickinson.
Yeah, we have a lawyer.
I actually called. I called Democracy Now! This morning in New York, and since I don't know as much as Mr. Peter about all these things, and was referred to freepress.org.net and downloaded Beginner's Guide on Understanding Media, which I gave to all the board members. And then I also got something called from Center for Digital Democracy, all about really current things with net neutrality and new resolutions in Congress. But I think that, you know, when you own something that's valuable, Mr. Miller, you're really in the position of strength. And just one paragraph down here, I'd like to read little sections of this. I mean, you have a chance to read it. Well, let me skip to what's page 13. Although decisions on media are made primarily at the national level, local authorities still wield considerable power. For example, cable companies need to negotiate with local governments for permission to dig up public streets and sidewalks, to lay wires, and to string wires on telephone poles. During these negotiations, local governments come to an agreement on what rates the cable company can charge. In addition, cable companies will often be required to perform additional services before laying wire, such as setting aside channels and studio space for public access programming and connecting local schools and libraries. Resolved. A strong tide of public opposition to new telecommunications legislation, both the House, H.R. 5252, and Senate 2686, led by SaveTheInternet.com and other advocacy groups, forestalled what would have been a major victory for a relative handful of cable operators and telephone companies. Had Congress completed its rewrite of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, broadband network operators would have been free to institute new tiered or differentiated levels of service based on discriminatory fee-based traffic management schemes. And if you do go to Clearwire's website, you know, there's different plans. Some cost a lot more than others. Some are friendly to business. So, I mean, I actually emailed them, too. You know, are you guys, what is your stance on net neutrality? I haven't heard back from Clearwire about that. But I think that we're giving up so much. Even if it were merely symbolic and say it doesn't matter if we sell it to them or not, they're going to do it anyway, you know, could at least vote. You know, we're going to vote for a free level playing field access to internet. And it's our opportunity as elected officials to make a stand on something that's extremely important for democracy, you might say.
I think that probably the most important thing, if the board isn't going to go forward, is to have a legal opinion as to what the rights and obligations are of both parties, the lessor and the lessee. Because in the agreement itself, it's clear that after the initial term and payment of $200,000, the lessee has the absolute right to extend the agreement so many years. And they're doing that because they need to make a business decision as to whether what they've developed is going to provide any capital for them to continue. So we don't have that option at that point in time. They do. So I think we may already have committed ourselves to something that we should know fully about. And so if we need to have that explained, that should probably happen with an opinion as to what's been committed and what's irreversible and what options exist at this point, because quite obviously there's no other party to negotiate with other than this entity at this point in time anyway.
So I think what I'm hearing the board say is that there is no one willing to take action on this item tonight, so we'll table this item for this evening. Yes?
They're non-negotiable or negotiable, so we have an item that we can either follow through or decide not to pursue.
Is that the consensus of the board, that that's what we want to look at? Okay, very good.
Mr. President, if yes. I could just kind of summarize what I'm hearing, is that we're taking this to our attorneys to take a look at the agreement in order to determine what the obligations are. One of the questions I heard is whether the payment to the school district is predicated upon prior agreements or whether it's predicated upon this particular amendment. And I think that's one question we could get the answer to. The second, I think we would seek advice as to whether this was a closed session item or an open session item and proceed accordingly.
I wonder if the board would entertain the possibility of moving item 9 up to the next slot so that the assembled folks don't have to go through a primer on the general fund summary report. So, as fascinating as it is.
Is there anybody interested in changing item, moving item 9 ahead at this point?
I second that.
Okay. Moving item 9 ahead of item number 6 so that... Okay. All right. Then let's move ahead with item number 9. Item number 9 is more discussion on the study session planning. I would remind the board that we chose a protocol for developing study session items. So far, we're at number 2, clarifying questions to be addressed, and that seems to be the sticking point with this particular item. I would also remind the board that when we talked about study session items, I believe that we agreed that the study session items would relate to things that we could talk about within a frame of reference, and that being the strategic plan. Is that everybody's understanding of that? Okay, good. I know we have several people that would like to speak this evening. We have 2 requests to address the board. I think we'll go ahead and do that right now if we can. And then if you'd like to address the board and you haven't filled out a yellow form, that's fine. As soon as one of the people is done, please raise your hand and you'll be called forward and you can have your 3 minutes to speak. So you want to go ahead, Mr. Spatafor?
We have a request to speak from Mr. Simon.
This question. First of all, with our district moving toward common assessment and its contracting of West Ed services, the rationale being that parents will be assured their children receive the exact same education, no matter which teacher is leading the class, many teachers feel that these neatly prepackaged, consumer-friendly, quality-controlled products are limiting academic freedom and dictating the direction of teaching and learning throughout the year. Teachers and students are being denied the academic freedom to take a critical approach to their own learning and teaching on a daily basis. Henry Giroux, author of Stealing Power, Youth, Corporate Power, and the Politics of Culture, writes, "Corporate education opposes such a critical approach because it cannot be standardized, routinized, and reduced to a prepackaged curriculum. On the contrary, a critical and transformative education, a practice that we should take seriously, allows us to have the ability to theorize, contextualize, and honor our students' diverse lives. As Mr. Tadone implied, San Luis Coastal teachers should have the power to determine the direction of a class. The relationship between teachers of the same course should be as colleagues and not as clones. Education is a process, not a prepackaged product. To answer your question, that is why we must ensure that San Luis Coastal Unified preserves academic freedom. Thank you.
Mr. Quisenberry?
Jim Quisenberry, teacher at Morro Bay High School, resident of Los Osos. Ivan Simon probably said it more succinctly than I ever will. However, the issue for me, too, also involves just how much the district wants to micromanage my classroom. I know that central administration doesn't like the board to micromanage them, and the teachers here are resisting the micromanagement of our. This is an opportunity for me as a teacher to let my students get familiar with a cultural icon of the post-World War I era and the 20s and even into the 30s. So like I often do, I live on the edge. I showed them the film. And, of course, there was a bit of anti-establishment in it. You know, Charlie had a confrontation with the police, shot one of them in the foot, kicked another one in the behind. And there was also a little bit of maybe even class warfare. You know, all the rich swells, they were pompous and incompetent. However, I felt that this was a teachable moment. I felt this was something that the students should see and it was valuable. And I made that decision independently. And to me, that's part of the academic freedom package, that my expertise, 32 years of teaching, that I should be allowed to make that decision, that I don't have to follow lockstep with what everybody else is teaching. And by the way, I know this addressed a standard because I was using a primary source, and I was encouraging analytical thinking because we sat down and talked about the film afterwards and what it might say about the times, the history, and the culture. Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who'd like to address the board? Mr. Evans.
Tony Evans, and I'm going to be talking about academic freedom at the primary level. It's not a question that I raise because we discuss a lot of hot topics there. Usually we're trying to figure out what the dividing line is between a potty mouth and appropriate language, but it really comes down to the kinds of choices I have as an educator and fulfilling the responsibility that I have as a teacher. In this district, we are fortunate that our children perform well, that we can take these standardized measurements and succeed at them. But you only have to look beyond our district to understand that academic freedom at every level is being threatened. And it's being threatened by creating, as people say, sort of a one approach fits all. And here the entire supposedly rationale behind all these things is that we meet the individual needs of children. But I need, as a teacher, if I'm going to get my students to perform at the high standards that are expected, and I only have to look at the face of my children. I took the district-adopted text curriculum and had them reading a story out of them that was at best mind-numbing and plotting for them. I then took a story from an adoption that we no longer have because it didn't meet, quote-unquote, the state standards and the rigorousness that you're supposed to have in a curriculum, and introduced a story from that to the children, and you saw their faces just light up because it was real literature. It was exciting to them. It really meant something to be a reader and not sort of a mindless decoding of words that didn't mean a whole lot and didn't even sound, as they were very correct to point out, didn't really sound like real talking. So my concern, and it's a concern I see, is that as schools get in trouble because they don't fulfill the testing requirements, teachers are then being put in the position to say, you will teach this, you will teach it this way, you will stop exercising that professional judgment that you have, And in doing that, I think we are actually selling short our ability to meet the needs of our children. And so I'm going to say academic freedom comes into effect at virtually every level. And I want those choices as a teacher. Thank you.
Other people who'd like to speak this evening on this topic? Come on down.
I'm Holly Naylor. I teach at Laguna Middle School Science, and I was 2 years in Los Osos and the rest of the time about the last 18 at Laguna. But I'm going to give you a little history of our science department and let you see how it fits into all of this. I was part of a unique team back in when I was hired in 1987. I worked with Diana Barnhart and David Buckmeyer. And they trained me as a Los Osos science teacher. And then I went off and worked at Laguna. And I took all of my skills that I had learned from those two to Laguna and tried to impart them into some older gentlemen who were teaching there. And they had their days. Tuesday was a certain particular lecture. And on Friday, they took the test at the end of the book. And Dick Andrus had a lot of faith in me. He said, Holly, train the new ones. So we had a real common bond between all of us teachers, including David and Diana from Los Osos. And so we even met with Barry Penley. At one point, the school district decided that we should articulate science K through 12. And we took all of the teachers, and we took 4 or 5 days out of the school year and made a very, very nice little articulation across the board. Excuse me. We have been very obedient, let's put it that way. Laguna science teachers have, every time the new adoption came around, we adopted. We went off into Science 2000 and brought the computers in, and we studied Kuru, and we were excited about this new program, which turned out to be just really awful. But we did it, and it was fun, and the kids actually enjoyed it, and we learned, and we all taught the standards. But in the long run, we kind of started sorting out our common assessments. Barry would send us our assessments, and we would have the kids take them. We'd send them back, and that was kind of the end of it. And so for us, we eventually used the best questions of those assessments, and we tailored it to our own specific teaching. And this is what makes teaching exciting. And those lessons that we taught for years and years and years, we only taught the best of those lessons. My kids change from first period to fifth period. We are constantly monitoring and adjusting our teaching. And so that's kind of just a history, but I think that the most important thing, I'm going to go way back to my last page. I had said here, we are obedient. We have also been CLAD trained, CTAP trained, EETT'd, web page proficient, and we have full inclusion of resource students and EL students in our science classes. Our class sizes have jumped. I remember Dick Andrus coming to me and apologizing when he put 25 in my class, and now we're at 32. We have additional team meetings. I'm on the Cultural of Poverty team. And so one more thing, if you wanted me to do it, yeah, we could do it. We could nod our head and we could say, yeah, we can do this. We already do it. And so we need to draw them in. We need to make teaching exciting. And the only way to do it is to give us our freedom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak to this topic this evening? Come on down, Judy.
I'm Judy Newhauser. I'm a parent of a high school student in Morro Bay, but I also teach at Pacheco in the dual immersion program. One of the things I think this school board has been really supportive of the Pacheco program, and boy, do we appreciate it. And I think you've discovered one of the fallacies of following along with the kind of some of the No Child Left Behind. We're a school that people are fighting to get into, and we're the fourth or perhaps fifth year improvement school, because of the way in which the standards testing is administered. And I think you have to be really careful in terms of sort of one size fit all. We're a school that one size doesn't fit all, and I'm really appreciative of the district's support for that. But I think that follows then down through the different programs also, and different subjects that we teach. I mean, I can also make the confession, I taught about, you know, the role of a flower in sixth grade. It's not part of my curriculum, but the plants in my room were flowering, you know, these enormous flowers that attract flies. And yes, ecology is part of what I teach later on in the year, although pollination of flowers for seed production is not part of the curriculum, but it's a very important understanding, basic understanding of how our world works. And I think we, as teachers, need to have that. I want to speak a little bit, too, about in services. I had the wonderful opportunity a couple of years ago. I'm actually a new teacher. I came into teaching in the classroom late in my life. And we got this wonderful in service with Joni Chaucer. I mean, she is fabulous. For me, it was perfect. For some of my colleagues, it was the third Joni Chaucer workshop they've gone to. There has to be flexibility. We all have our needs, and we all have to be able to figure out what is it we need. Just as we provide differentiation for students in our classroom, we as teachers also need differentiation in what our in-services are going to be, and we need some input into that. Thank you.
Anyone else wish to address the board this evening? Mr. Madrigian.
Can we get to specific questions? Academic freedom occurs when a teacher is empowered to make professional judgments in his or her area of expertise in a sincere effort to teach state standards and district curriculum. Teachers employ this freedom to inspire, excite, and generate interest in their students. As teachers, we are not asking for the right to teach unrelated, controversial topics or use inappropriate materials in our classrooms. Rather, we simply hope to be treated as professionals who believe they can make a difference when empowered by an administration that believes teachers will offer meaningful input when invited to collaborate and explore possible improvements for our students' education. The San Luis Coastal Teachers Association would like to work collaboratively with central administration and site principals in a collegial effort to ensure that the following questions are answered. First, are teachers and administrators working together in a constructive manner to make educationally sound curriculum decisions? Second, how can we ensure that teachers and administrators will work together when selecting professional development or in-service programs or speakers for our teachers? Third, are teachers being treated as professionals when their judgment concerning what medium they use to teach the standards and curriculum must be approved by an administrator ahead of time? And finally, when teachers are told what to teach, when to teach it, and what materials to use, does their morale and effectiveness as teachers suffer? And finally, I just would like to add that at this last meeting that we had here, I used some strong metaphorical language to criticize some of the questions that the administration put forward and in that board packet. I got wrapped up in my passions, and because this is an important issue to teachers, and I just want the board to know that I apologize privately to Dr. Valentine, but since I made those publicly, I wanted to pause. Give the teachers and central administration an opportunity to see if we can work this out before we go to a study session. And maybe this would be a great opportunity for us to build bridges, find some common ground where we can agree, and maybe it doesn't even have to go to a study session. I think that would be an opportunity for us to work together and come back and report back to the board with what we find.
Thank you. I'm going to lead off, and Dr. Valentine proposed some questions, and I heard what you said, Bruce, and I want to reassure you about that. And frankly, from what I've heard from folks this evening, and what I'm seeing is the questions that Dr. Valentine has suggested that we consider, there are questions here that I think are great. And I'm going to go through some of the questions that I think directly relate to this discussion. One of the questions that I think we need to get answered is, what are the standards that are expected to be taught, recognizing that there are a lot of standards and that we can't possibly get through all of them in one evening. But I think a representation of what some of those might look like. The next question that was suggested is, what opportunities exist to edit the standards based upon teacher priorities? And I guess teacher priorities, in my opinion, would be defined as teacher priorities based upon what they consider student priorities to be. And I would hope that when we're talking about teacher priorities, that's what we're talking about, the priorities of teachers based upon what the needs of students are. How do we as a district expect the standards to be taught? I think that's a reasonable question. And then the next thing that we're talking about is, what room for individual professional judgment and creativity is there in the teacher, in the teaching of the standards? As a school administrator, I would expect personally that my teachers use creativity when teaching. I think that what I'm hearing is, I'm not hearing anyone suggests that we don't support the standards or that the standards aren't something that we are required to teach. I think what the question is there leniency by the schools and by the administration? From my perspective as a professional educator, I do think it's important that we talk about opportunities for collaboration and group decision making. I've talked about this before. The movement toward professional learning communities, I think, is tremendously important. And what we're going to be seeing is, of course, response to intervention from the special education perspective, which ties into professional learning communities. What can we do to help all students learn in all classrooms? What voices go into the development of curriculum, the adoption of materials, the determination of site plans, the development of strategic plan, and so forth? Not only what voices go in there, what are the opportunities for voices of varying kinds to go into those decisions? The connection between professional judgment, creativity, and the teacher evaluation process. I understand and support that. When I look at this from my little perspective, I think about this and I think, okay, we want professional judgment and creativity, but when does a teacher cross the line? And I don't know if that's something that that's appropriate for us to talk about at a board level meeting, but if every day a teacher is showing a video that would be questionable as to its appropriateness for that classroom, is that professional judgment and creativity, or is that just simply laziness? I don't know. And at what point do we say that it's time to stop and time to do something else? How far can we go? The question was, what are the constraints? What's flexible? And then the overarching question is, well, I'm going to say the question is, how does this all relate to students? And I would say, how does this relate to students, their parents, and the community? Because there is this expectation that our students come first and that we have an obligation, like it or not, to teach our students so that they can achieve at least, if nothing else, so that they can have the opportunities to do whatever it is that they want when they get on with their lives. Like it or not, I think we cannot ignore the high school exit exam.
something we haven't had to face in this school district too much yet, are talking about students who have certificates of completion, which is clearly not an acceptable alternative to a high school diploma. I think we owe it to our students to give them the opportunity and see what arises. Now, if there are other discussions that I think between the administration and other members of our community, our San Luis Coastal community, would like to have, I would support those, and I would support those in discussions between the various parties at this point. And that's going to be my suggestion. Mr. Spadafore?
Thank you, Mr. Unger. I'm going to thank you and appreciate the input and the discussion of those question items, and I also want to thank Mr. Bedrigian regarding the offer to continue to work with the administration and everybody involved with the education of our children on improving every aspect of the classroom in terms of how it's taught and how it's received. But I have a different feeling about a study session. I think that the guidelines we develop serve a good purpose, because I think a study session has to be well-defined, and I think it has to have a specific goal. Because otherwise, if you look at these items and you discuss each one and you look at them, you could have a lot of people here in a study session talking, and it could go on for a long time. And I'm not opposed to having a long discussion about all these related issues that are important. But I think there is a value to multiple processes that exist in our district, because we have good administration, we have good staff, we have wonderful teachers. And I think the part that can happen between ongoing discussions discussed is valuable. I think that a study session has to be a little bit more focused, though. I've had such a hard time over the last 2 months trying to pinpoint what the questions would be. And even if you have 12 questions, the number of people who may be involved in discussing that and what may come from that, who knows? And I'm saying it's not worth the effort if it doesn't lead to something that's concrete. And it's not worth the effort if a multitude of people are involved in preparing the material to discuss on one day, when something needs to be discussed day after day, month after month, in the school system as it goes forward, because those are our goals and that's part of our strategic plan. My feeling that a study session isn't appropriate is based upon the fact that I think, from hearing everybody speak, there are two items that jump out at me. One is professional development in service is mentioned many, many times, that the teachers have an interest in discussing that in maybe a more focused way. And I think, as a suggestion, that could be an agenda item where it can be brought back and there doesn't have to be the production involved with a study session. And the second item, which I think I'm going to turn this over to Adrian to discuss, are the guidelines plus making a couple of agenda items, one that I've suggested and I think one that Adrian's going to suggest may prove to be a better solution.
Before I talk about this next idea, I think that the big frame of this is that the No Child Left Behind puts districts under stress, because we have impossible goals to meet and ever more impossible. And I think that the administration has the same goals as the teachers and the board and the parents and the children. We all want great education for the kids. And everyone who's working, that I work with here and in all arenas of education, I really enjoy working with all of you, and I think you're wonderful people. But we are under stress. We might as well admit it, and it's going to become more intense. And the administration responds by, you know, wanting to control it more. That's what I'm seeing. Because we have no choice. We have to have these ever higher percentages of students testing and ever higher levels of proficiency, and that's a lot of stress. So it's understandable that they would respond in some kind of way, and it seems to be that they're responding in a way of, let's all get on the same page and we can make it happen. And then the teachers are responding that that's not fun, and that's not what I was trained to do, and I cannot be the best teacher that I can be with that kind of a system. So there's a little different response there. So I think if we recognize what we're all going through in the nature of the beast, I mean, the standards, too, are not really written by educators. I mean, it would be fun to talk about who actually wrote those, because that's an interesting story. But so I think that we kind of have had a study session in a way, spread out over time, already in a little different format, and some specifics are coming forward. And one of them, I second the motion, if it is, to have an agenda item on professional development and the teacher input into that and what that's looking like, and because there are a lot of voices coming through on that topic. So we're hearing that, and I think it should be an agenda item. And that way we can have administration say what they want to say about it, because they haven't really had a chance to speak. And we can have the teachers again, and I know they have some data and things to share on that. The one I want to bring up is Board Policy 6161.11, consistent with criteria developed for the selection and evaluation of other instructional materials. If the teacher believes that the materials may be in conflict with district criteria, the teacher shall confer with the principal or designee before using them. When using supplementary materials, teachers shall provide appropriate introductory and follow-up activities. In addition, teachers shall ensure that supplementary materials are used in conjunction with the use of basic texts or teaching activities. All materials must be used within legal copyright limits. So that's basically saying teachers are professionals and can choose supplemental materials at their discretion based on this criteria. Then it has a separate little part, films, videos. When a teacher desires to show a film, videos that has not been approved by the district or county for use, such as something that's already in the library or whatever, in the grade level taught, or in any other school-related activity, the teacher and the principal or designee shall preview the film to determine whether, in his or her professional judgment, it is consistent with district criteria for the selection of instructional materials. I would like to change that, and I would like to make a motion that we change board policy, and that... Okay, I'm not making a motion. I'm sharing an idea. My idea is that films and videos be considered supplementary instructional materials, and that the teacher, as a professional, make the same choice of that as pulling a little book off the shelf any other thing.
Could and you think about that as maybe an advanced agenda item?
As an advanced agenda item, here it comes. But I really have never taught in a district that requires the principal to look at everything first. And I make professional judgments all the time in clips and things that I show. And I take that as a great responsibility. And I don't think you can be a good teacher if you have to have your principal preview those kind of materials.
I think the questions on page 9.2 are excellent. I would add to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th bullet point down, we include professional development in that one. Then I would add a final, well, not final, but I would add another question. Along the lines of, what are the professional requirements of teachers to support state standards and district curriculum? As a lawyer, there are many times that I'm stuck with state law and time on preparing for it, and I think it will lead to valuable discussion even if it does take a while. And I like these questions.
I have to agree, I think, with John, and the preponderance of information that was sent to me, there definitely is a split between the staff development piece of this and the academic freedom piece of this. And I'd like to propose that we keep those separate.
I agree. I think we should perhaps keep those two things separate, and I think it would be a great board item to discuss the professional development in-service stuff. I think it'd be a great discussion. The one question I had that I would love to try to find the right forum to dig into a little bit was, Mr. Quisenberry, I enjoyed all of your presentations. Thank you. But and I thought that, you know, the teachable moments concept is one that I think is wonderful. I loved hearing the story about Charlie Chaplin, and Mr. Bedrigian talked about one in the last board meeting. My concern, though, is when that issue is raised, are you necessarily implying that whether it's your colleagues or your principal or central administration is imposing some sort of criteria that would say that you can't take advantage of those teachable moments, that there's some structure in place right now or is being imposed that says that you can't or shouldn't be doing that. And I would love to understand that issue more. It's something, you know, that piques my interest quite a bit.
Just a follow-up comment. Study sessions are actually designed for the board to learn stuff from you all, among others. And I agree with you, Dave. I've said this before. I don't really understand what the reality for teachers is like. And why shouldn't we hold a study session and explore these things? I was not an enthusiast of holding this study session on academic freedom, but the more I've gotten input from folks and heard things, I think we have important things to talk about. I don't think we should cut off professional development, at least in the preliminary discussion. And keep in mind, fellow board members, that sometimes there's board and administrative prerogatives in the way we decide things that we shouldn't be in too big a rush to relinquish, because they're awfully hard to get back. As we've improvement, development, progress, growth are we trying to achieve for our teachers through professional development? Are we focused on an individual teacher's background and resume, and therefore we want to direct the professional development for him or her specifically? Are we looking for a generalized requirement within the educational community that we need to bring all of our teachers up to speed on? Those are some of those pieces that I don't understand. And frankly, until I get a better grasp on things, and I think I'm hearing the same thing from Dave, I'm not sure whether we have an academic freedom issue in this district or not. And that's kind of what I really want to explore more. And if we do have one, then, you know, then we need to work it. If we don't have one, then I want to know that too. So I vote for the study set.
I just want to acknowledge some folks that sent emails to us, some teachers that did, and that's Christine Carlin from Laguna Middle School, Debbie Heck from Laguna Middle School, Eva DeSanto, I believe she's at Laguna Middle School, and Jim Nett, who I believe is also at Laguna Middle School. I don't think that we need to take action on this item as a motion. However, to try to get a consensus for the feeling of the board, I think what I would like to propose is a study session focusing on the questions, perhaps winnowed down a little bit, that were proposed, and see whether this is something the board would support. Now, I think that biting off that plus the professional development might be too much for one thing, and those might be two separate issues. And I'll put it out there as that, and let me try and see if we can get some consensus from the board on this. Is there support from the board to go ahead with a study session relating to the questions that are proposed on 9.2? Is there consensus for moving forward with that? Mr. Buckman is shaking his head. Mr. Miller, what do you think? I'm just trying to get a feeling for
where
we're going with this.
Well, I guess I'm in favor of it, but so if somebody brings up professional development at the study session, are we going to cut them off?
Well,
I'm curious.
What's your take on this? If the board were to say tonight, yes, we want to proceed with a study session, what would your game plan be?
Yeah, I think the game plan would be, first of all, to provide the board with a set of standards just to make sure that the what of teaching is something that's that you can reach some kind of comfort level with. Then when we get to the question of the how of teaching and the teachable moment, the ability to adjust individual student needs in the classrooms and so forth, I think we would turn to two things. Number one would be something called the California, pardon the expression, Standards for the Teaching Profession, which essentially take a look at those professional judgments, creative decision-making, responding to the student's background and interests and so forth, and elevate them from things that that would be simply be desirable to things which are actually expected within the context of the standards. Third, I think we would look at our teacher evaluation system and try to make sure that we understand, first of all, what that teacher evaluation system is, and within that evaluation system, what are the kinds of things that are expected of teachers in the area of professional judgment and creative decision-making. Beyond that, I mean, I think those would be the springboards into it. Oh, I know. Also, take a look at what mechanisms exist for teacher input into curriculum development, material adoption, school site planning, strategic planning, and those kinds of things. Those are things that are actually kind of definable, and who's represented and how they're represented and how the process goes and so forth. And then just let the conversation go where that takes us.
Does that help you, Marilyn? Okay. Given what Dr. Valentine said, how do you feel, Marilyn? Is that something that you would support?
Yeah, I would support having a study session on that.
Okay. John?
Just to follow up with Dr. Valentine and see if we have four areas and a suggestion as to maybe how we can approach this so the board can be educated and we can have a meaningful discussion. If you have, so it would be nice if there could be a development with staff, with the teachers, and that could be a four-part structure for a study session with the joint input of everyone who's connected to that. Does that make any sense at all?
I want to make sure.
I'm a little confused. I'm sorry.
Would you see the recommendations being something that came out of the study session or something that went into the study session?
No, my sense is that what goes into the study session is what exists, those four areas that we've discussed, just to try to get it to 4 points. Professional development in service. The second is guidelines in the classroom for teachers in terms of implementing the standards. Third is teacher evaluation system. And the fourth is curriculum development. What is in place at this point? So what exists? And then the second list would be what suggestions there are from staff, from teachers, to modify, change, improve. So it's not recommendations. It's something that we can use as a framework in those four areas. And I'm just giving that as an attempt to try and make these more manageable within what we've discussed, because that's what I hear coming back over and over again, those four areas.
Reaching consensus on those four areas with diverse input could be a challenging task.
Well, is there a present system that those four areas? So
yeah,
we have
all the what is there. That's
okay.
That's
so what exists is there. Now the other part would just be what areas would be discussed to modify, to change, to alter, to enlarge, to improve, whether it be the teacher's ability to teach, whether it be the student's ability to learn, what would improve the students in that context.
And that's what would happen at the study session itself. Thank you. I understand now.
Okay, Mrs. Dickinson?
You might change that second. You had professional development, curriculum development, basically, an evaluation, and then that, you said something about teacher expectation of how you teach in the classroom, but that could be what Dr. Valentine called the standards for teachers. And there's room for interpretation there if you're talking about teacher expected to assess. You know, we might say, my assessment is that my students are bored with this story, and we're going to bail on it and read something different. You know, and so that you might, the teacher might feel that's required for her to assess.
We put in place a framework for that session along the lines of what you've just described?
That's what I was thinking of. If it were to cover areas that everyone wants to discuss and that we want to learn more about.
Yeah.
But I was thinking that what would help would be to understand what's in place relative to those four areas now and what options exist or what recommendations or what thoughts can be presented to discuss. And instead of that coming at the end of the study session, it would come before the study session so we can make sure that we have all of that before us when we discuss it. Okay. That was my thought.
Okay.
Then I think that's a great idea. And provided, you know, as I've said at past meetings, I think it's really important that we have solicit as much information and input as we can from the teaching community out there as we get ready for this session.
Well, we have offers already to work and communicate and to start the process, and that's wonderful to do that. I mean, it's a great place to begin.
Sure, and then I'd like to get to Dr. Valentine and wrap this up, if I could, please.
Sure. I'm getting the material ahead of time. I mean, we can all access standards on the Internet. I don't think we need, you know, a copy of all the standards. You want to just give us the website, ca.gov.something, who knows it. Mm-hmm. They're all there.
Yep. Okay. Dr. Valentine, can you do me a favor and for the boards, just so that we're all clear about what it is that you heard and to make sure that what you heard is what the board is thinking about, and then we hopefully can move on with this?
Yeah. Yes, what I heard was to focus the study session, first of all, with preliminary information, preparatory information on professional development, curriculum development, guidelines for teachers in the classroom, and teacher evaluation, and that there would be preliminary work on what is in those particular areas to help prepare for the session. And then the session's focus would be on recommendations as to how these things are working, how they could be improved upon, and topics related to making those even stronger than they are.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I think we've now spent at least 3 hours over three board meetings trying to establish whether or not we want to have a study session. So if this is what it's going to take...
That said, can we get some... Is the board in consensus that this is what we're going to do so we can move on?
We said we'd go forward.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
If I may. Okay, I think, Chris, may I say, then just real briefly? And I think the board consensus is to go forward as we discussed. I just want to mention one thing, and I don't want to belabor this too much or beat a dead horse, but I think the discussions we've had, even though it's been several hours, I really feel that it's helped in many, many ways. I think it's helped to find some issues, and I think it's also helped with certain groups to possibly, in this effort to communicate, to possibly develop ideas along different lines. I think that's important, too. So, but we can disagree about that.
And we don't necessarily disagree about that, and I've enjoyed the input that I've had from outside, from people who really are, you know, who have their hands on the students. It's not that. It's just among ourselves, this has gone on and on and on, and it feels quite belabored to me. So if we're having a study session, I just hope that people have saved up some comments for the study session.
How about if we move on to item number 6, a primer on the general fund summary report? Okay. Are
we taking a break?
We'll take a 5-minute break.
Your consciousness far greater than any discussion on academic freedom that you might. As a matter of fact, this is an epitome of academic freedom. This is a learning experience. No, he's not started yet. to do is just break it down in its components, and then if you have questions about it, I'll entertain those questions and do my best to answer them. But understand that this is a summary report of the board's and the school district's budget that's developed sometime in May, altered in October and January, and then finally it's audited by the auditors at the end of the fiscal year, June 30th. So you see it at least four times a year. Sometimes if we do some major adjustments, you'll see it an extra one or two times. But essentially, what we have is we have the revenues, the expenditures, and then the breakdown of the district's reserve. And let's take revenues first. And you have this in your board book in a certain format. The first thing I'd like to do, and I apologize for those that are on the screen, is to talk about the form in its entirety. And you can see up there that we have the projected budget and the first interim reports. And we have it broken down into revenues, expenditures, and components of the ending balance. Those are the three elements that we focus on in a general sense. Within the revenue piece, oops. Within the revenue piece, we have revenue limit income, we have federal grants, state income, and locally generated revenues. The revenue limit sources are basically for us local property taxes and related income from property taxes. It's by far and away our largest source of revenues in a category. The federal sources are expected allocations from federally funded grants. We get grants for such things as Title I, special ed, and other areas of the federal budget.
Russell, are these the monies that would be in jeopardy based on No Child Left Behind?
Yes, it would. The federal government uses their...
So this is the leverage that they have over us, the $3 million in federal monies?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
It also would include some state programs, too.
State programs that are federally funded?
Yeah, that are pass-through like money. Pass-through, exactly. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
We also that we categorize according to a standard established by the state. And we use a four-digit designator to further identify those. All 1,000s have something to do with certificated or teacher salaries. All 2,000s have something to do with classified salaries. All 3,000s have something to do with employee benefits. All 4,000s have something to do with instructional materials. All 5,000s have something to do with outside services or utilities or other operating expenses. All 6,000s are capital outlay expenditures, and 7,000s are the miscellaneous types of transfers between funds and programs that we might do. Mr.
Are there
Peter.
Any salaries embedded in the operations and other category, or is that strictly?
Nope. All salaries are either 1,000s or 2,000s. Related salary expenses are all 3,000s. Okay. Now, the concept of our fund balance can be explained as the difference between our revenues and our expenditures. And within, I'm going to have to go back to this bigger chart to illustrate. Within let me find it on here. The net increase and decrease in fund balance, you come down with your total expenditures subtracted from your total revenues, and you get a revenue over expense. If that number is a positive, you are said to be operating within your revenues. If it is a negative, you are said to be operating with deficit funding. Deficit funding is something you generally want to avoid. In some cases, it could be acceptable from the viewpoint that you are using one-time money to fund one-time expenditures in these accounts that will result in this number being a negative, or this none right here, this one being a negative, as we see in our first interim. The reason our first interim is in a deficit position is because we used a substantial amount of one-time money. You pay your bills, and what's left over, you put it in your savings account. It's spendable for a future point in time. So at this moment in time, we are projected off of our beginning balance of $9.3 million, subtract our deficit spending of $1 million, we'll have $8.2 million in our savings account. Now, the savings account is broken down into four different areas, and this has been by practice, policy, and just general understanding between the board and staff about how to report this. We have four different areas. Some of them are mandated, and some of them we've developed on our own for better understanding of how our finances work. The first set of numbers, the prepaids, the revolving cash stores, and the 5% economic uncertainty, those are mandated as categories by the state. The 5%, it's only mandated for three. Board comfort level at this moment in time is 5%. That subtotal is $3 million of the $8 million in the ending balance. In addition, we have restricted programs. Restricted programs, by their nature, have their own savings account. We get a certain amount of money. We spend money. Whatever's left over, it's called carryover, is a balance left in a restricted account. That restricted account has to be maintained as a separate identity within your financial statement, and we do that through these types of designations. You can see at the beginning of our year, we had a tremendous amount of money. That's because as we close the year, we establish those carryovers and we record them for the beginning July 1st. Right after July 1st, we reallocate them according to the expenditures that the school site councils or the administration or the teachers wish to see them placed into. So we moved $1.5 million, this number right here, up into the expenditures, these numbers up here, and we were left with the $1 million that you see at the first interim. This also contributes to our deficit spending. The concept there is we take money that was one time, wasn't revenue, never identified in revenue, and we move it into an expenditure. You don't want to commit $100,000 of a Morro Bay water agreement for multi-year expenditure obligations of teacher salaries or benefits or buying some certain curriculum every year. It doesn't work. You run out of money the first year. And then how do you fund it in years 2 through 9 or 10? It doesn't work well. So, excuse me, one of the things we ended up doing was taking and identifying one-time money. If the board has any need, an identified need, to spend money on a one-time item, we've got a source to go to in our savings account to make that happen. And it's not a recurring obligation to have to pay for. And finally, we have lottery and other. In our attempt to be conservative in our approach towards uncertain revenue streams, one of the approaches we take is to record the revenue and isolate the money until the following year. Then we are assured of two things. One, that we got the money. That's very important. The second one is the next year's money comes also. We have a tendency with lottery money to judge it as a recurring income stream. And it really isn't, but it is. It has been, and it probably always will be, but the uncertainty still exists. So in our attempt to be conservative, we identify it and then put it into a holding account for 1 year, and then in that next year, we spend that year's money. And we always have 1 year in arrears. We also do that with with our MAW money and our mandated cost reimbursement. Now, mandated cost reimbursements we're actually locking down for 3 years because the state is on a very aggressive attack against mandated costs, and they have the right to audit us for 3 years. What we're trying to do is lock that down so that in case they audit us and find a problem, we'll always have the money available to repay. Just for your information, the Clearwire money that we received is located in the unappropriated reserves at the bottom, which is another category of lottery and other. It's just what's left over and hasn't been identified. So it's located at the bottom. We have other areas of identification, but ultimately the lottery and other is always money that's 1 year in arrears or at some point in the future will be released. When you add up all four of those categories,
expected to receive $112,000 and some change, and as of the first interim, we had received $200,000. It's got the eight beside it. It's down there under lottery.
Yeah, I see the MAW reimbursement for $200,000. Oh, right here. Yes. What happened is that at the end of the year, we had $112,000 in MAW reimbursement. Okay. Now we allocate. Some of that, 50% of that goes to the school sites for reimbursement of their activity and their expenditures. And then 50% of that, the other 50% of it, we attach back into these expenditures somewhere up here. Okay? So it disappeared. The 112 disappeared. Now we got a new $200,000 allocation in this particular school year. Okay, so one was the carryover, leftover balance, and then there's a new allocation coming at us that'll amount to 200.
Did any part of the 112 go into the mandated cost reimbursement that we're holding?
No, two separate things.
Okay.
Two separate things.
Thank you.
Any other questions on what this is? Basically, that's your primer for the evening on...
I think you do such a great job. I'm in the fan club.
Sometimes I'd like to do better.
Russell, I'm wondering, I know as many times as I have seen this form and as many times as I've been in your office asking you to please explain this form to me, the executive summary, you would call it, or the overview of it, is so easy to understand. I'm wondering if I could get board support to have that attached every time we receive this form, just for our help in reading it.
You don't need board support. I'll just give it to you. No problem.
Okay, that would be wonderful for me.
I use it for my own ease of understanding, too. If we look at the alternative to this summary, it's a 300-page production off of the computer that nobody... In a half an hour or half a day could actually go through. So what I really like is to see this summary first. It gives me an idea of what particular areas I need to examine further because something looks off or the trend. Okay, now I understand.
Just one question. It's probably not one that could be answered tonight, but I am curious about where we, in comparison to other basic aid school districts, where our ratios fall in terms of what we spend on teacher salaries as a percentage of our overall budget versus other basic aid districts, just, you know, in the different categories. Okay. I just use teachers as an example.
One of the interesting things that we ran into when we were looking at the reserve amounts is that there are 60-odd basic aid districts in the state of California, and that goes up and down every year because the measurement of being basic aid, some are right on the knife's edge of being basic aid, so they report as basic aid. But the next year, because property taxes go down or whatever, the oil revenues are declining, they fall out of basic aid. One of the interesting questions that makes these kinds of comparisons difficult is, what are the characteristics of basic aid that make us similar? Okay, and you could say enrollment, you could say revenues, you could say geographical area. And so to answer that question fairly, there are many, many basic aid districts are less than 2,000 kids. And that's what makes them basic aid. And then there are a few that are over 10,000. But most of them are in that 2,000 to 4,000 range. We're one of the larger, I would say, in the top 25% in terms of enrollment. So, you know, now, in order to make that comparison for you, we'd have to have some criteria. It gets difficult. But I'll do that anyway.
Well, I'm just curious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Similarly sized districts. I'm just curious to know the main ratios. What we
the people at SF2 that you heard from school services are actually doing a very formal survey of all basic aid districts about that kind of a question, and so they're going to have what are the reserves, what are the teacher salaries as a percentage of budget, et cetera, et cetera. So if we can be patient, and I think it comes out in March, then that might be a good way to get that answer.
I was just going to say that's a really interesting question because when I look at the reason for our basic aid status and we look at our unitary tax, I don't think there's any other school district in California that is a basic aid school district for the same reasons that we are.
I don't know of any. Property taxes is one way of getting their oil revenues.
Okay. Shall we move on to item number 7, nomination for re-election to CSBA Delegate Assembly? And no, it's not me. I'm already doing it. My term expires next year, and so the question is, do we want to nominate someone for CSBA Delegate Assembly?
Heck yeah.
And I think we have someone who is interested.
Is Ed going to present this?
I don't know. Ed, are you going to present this, or you want to talk about that? I'm sorry. I'm kind of jumping over.
You're on a roll, Chris. Keep at it.
basically, our area, which is Region 9C, San Luis Obispo County, has two delegates to the Delegate Assembly. I'm one of them, and Jeannie Duggar from Paso Robles is another. Jeannie Duggar's term is expiring, and so the question is there anyone who has an interest in becoming being nominated to become a delegate for the CSBA Delegate Assembly? You'd have to fill out the forms, and then you would be placed in front of each school district in our area, and each school board would have one vote toward your potential victory. So if there's interest in here, we would like to hear that right now.
Well, Mr. Unger, President Unger, humility usually prevents me from suggesting myself for some roles such as this, but I've watched you as a CSBA delegate over the past how many years? 2 years?
Four
years. Excuse me. You're third. Yeah, and it just seems like you have such a good time that I kind of want to. I want to be near the center of power as well.
Okay.
And I at least a couple of school districts I should do okay with. Anyway, but I will be more than happy to fill out the paperwork if my fellow board members decide to support me.
Did the fellow board members support?
Yes, I'll move.
Go ahead.
I'll move that we advance Walter Millar as our CSBA delegate.
Okay, and so it's been moved by Mrs. Roger and seconded by Mrs. Dickinson that we move Walter's name forward as a to be nominated to run for Delegate Assembly from Region 9C, which is our area. You will have to fill these out, and Mrs. Holmes can help you do that. She's quite good at those things. Okay. All in favor?
2008, which would permit the board to meet in three different locations, one in San Luis Obispo, one in Los Osos, and one in Morro Bay. We set aside a certain number of meetings while schools were not in session to meet here at the district office, and then divided the remaining meetings into three parts. Meeting at Los Osos Middle School in Los Osos, meeting at Del Mar Elementary School in Morro Bay, and meeting here at the district office in San Luis Obispo. And we submit this for your consideration.
Okay. Does it look good, everybody? Dave?
Yeah. Just one comment. I think Mark made a great suggestion last time that... Pardon me?
that if a school were to invite us, or I'm sorry, Adrian did, were to invite us to hold a meeting at their school as part of a presentation they might give, I think we should consider that.
Absolutely.
And so maybe we can establish a, you know, give us 30 days notice and we can hold a meeting at your school if you're going to present, or whatever it may be. Yeah. Well, you have to. We need to make sure we have the time to do the appropriate notifications.
Raffle off the board.
Yeah.
Okay. So, do we need a motion on this, Dr. Valentine, or is this a? Okay. Would somebody like to make a Would somebody like to make a motion that we adopt the calendar as proposed in item number 8, with the modification that we notify schools that if they would like to have a school board meeting at their site. Notify the central administration, and actually we would invite them to notify us that we would go ahead with a reasonable notice to hold it at the very at other school sites other than those that are listed here.
I might have made that motion.
You know, I was going to make that motion, but you took the words
so moved
and set them so well. But I would add that I think it's we should recognize the fact that we placed meetings in Morro Bay and Los Osos on the coast. So we're recognizing all three communities in the school district in terms of having the meetings. And I second Chris's motion.
I didn't make that motion.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. Move on to the action consent agenda. Is there anybody from the public that would like to comment on an item in the action consent agenda? Okay. Item number 10, approval of certificated and classified personnel items.
Pull.
Okay. Item number 11, in intent standards for California public schools.
I'd like that pull.
19, approval of out-of-state field study trip, Morro Bay High School concert and jazz bands for the spring music retreat at Lake Tahoe and the Reno Jazz Festival.
Can we just say go brand without pulling it? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Would somebody like to make a motion on these?
I'll make a motion.
Okay.
I'd like to make a motion that we approve 12, 13, 14, 15, and 19.
It's been moved by Mr. Spadafore and seconded by Mr. Millar. All in favor?
Aye.
Carries opposed. Carries 7-0. Item number 10. John.
Thank you. I just had a quick question for Rick. Thank you. On page 10.2, we have a paraeducator resigning out of Baywood. And there's some scuttlebutt about reasons for that. And I know that last year we spent quite a bit of time discussing hiring, retention, expanding, and 2 years ago giving different duties to paraeducators and increasing their salary. If there's other support on the board in a Friday packet, I'd like to get a little bit of information what our district's experience has been over the last year and a half regarding hiring, retaining, and some of the problems we're having in those two areas with paraeducators, if that's okay.
Okay.
Right. Thank you. And then I make a motion that item number 10 be approved as set forth.
Second.
It's been moved by Mr. Spadafore, seconded by Mrs. Roger. All in favor?
Aye.
Carry opposed. Carry 7-0. Item number 11, Ms. Dickinson.
I just had a quick question on the addition of, we're having Columbus Day because of, due to leap year, it sounds like, for a holiday. We don't usually, right? And I think it's, all holidays are gratefully received. We love holidays. I just wanted to say that Columbus Day is a controversial delineation. It's not what it, but maybe we could just call it like, you know, like Native American History Day and go on a holiday. I just wanted to recognize the fact that, just to honor the diversity of opinion on that topic, at least, that we're really glad to have a holiday, but we don't want to change the name to Columbus.
18 and 18 together with Damien, sure. If that's okay. I have a question for Damien, for you, please. this goes back to that issue regarding athletic participation no longer being allowed as credit towards the physical education requirement. And there's a note here that someone was contacted at the state about that, and I think this individual said not to her knowledge. So it sounded like there may have been something, there may not have been something. I don't know how far her knowledge extends throughout the state. But my question is, when you look at number 18, where you have the standards for physical education, mm-hmm. is there a possibility of embedding those standards in the athletic endeavors? So what you have is a embedded course that way?
I don't think that there's a chance of having a pure athletic PE course. I think there is a chance of, in a course one and course two situation, if you took the standards as a whole, and as we come to better understand those standards, there might be some ability to preserve some elective courses as a choice over course one and course two. But as a pure athletic PE course, there wouldn't be a way to just have that happening with the standards courses, at least as we understand them right now.
Oh, so if those standards were embedded fully and shown that they are, that athletic,
it wouldn't be an athletic PE course, because many of the standards in the course one and course two require specific activities. Square dancing would be a standard in a course two course. So if you had an athletic PE soccer course, they'd have to take time out to do a square dancing unit and then assess it and do those kinds of things. And as you went down the list, you'd be hard pressed to continue to have what athletic PE serves now, which is to practice the sport.
Well, thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, Mrs. Dickinson, did you have a question about this?
I just had a question on 16 unrelated to PE. I know you may not be done, though.
I was just going to make a motion. You could do that for me when you are done.
I'll
if you
want
to
do
that. 16 and 18.
I just wanted to ask about page 16.5, in English and Social Science, a comprehensive sequential career education program has been developed. My question is, is that an addition to the English and Social Studies curriculum that they already have to cover in their standards, the career education program? And they do it in English and Social Studies. It sounds like really worthwhile, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, that sounds great. And I had one quick question about the special ed science. It says physical science. Do they have, does that change? I mean, do they like rotate through, you know, human body and biology? Is it always physical? This is like an SDC class?
The SDM class is the special education modified, which would not be, that would be, there's two, there's the SE and then the SEM, and those are different levels of modification based on the students in those
and
classes.
Is it physical science always, or do you have?
Yes.
It always is.
Yes.
They don't have biology or anything? And life science for SC too? Okay, cool. Yeah, that's good. All right, that was my only questions on 16.
Okay, and before I make that motion, I would say that if our football team did square dancing as part of the endeavor, I think it could cause their opponents to be caught by surprise, actually, when the game started. But
I see ballet myself.
Besides our ballet. But I move that 16 and 18 be approved as set forth in the agenda.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Second by Mr. Peter. All in favor?
Aye.
Carry 7-0. Item number 17, Mrs. Dickinson.
I just wanted to do a compliment to the school district and Mr. Barnett and Alfred, the great offerings and variety in the classes offered. Hospitality, tourism, and food service ROP. You know, in these cities of Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo, you know, it's so great for kids to have training in that and get credit for it. Teaching careers ROP. They can get out there and decide if they want to be a teacher or not. Fashion design. You know, those kind of classes, I think, are so awesome that they have such a wide spectrum of opportunity. And I know you mentioned the process where teachers can have ideas for what to teach and bring those forward. I had one question on the special ed on that one, too. I think it's so interesting that you have, on page 51, special ed modified and special ed include regular and special education students. Instruction is delivered in an integrated program. That's in the same class, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry, though, about like delivering special ed services to people without IE. 2007 and 8.
Okay, I think we all received in our Friday packet the information from Mr. Miller regarding a sort of an informal survey that we took of reserves for basic aid school districts, and we all attended the Schools for Sound Finance breakfast where it was suggested that 10 to 12% would be a prudent reserve for basic aid school districts. So I would just like to agendize, if I can get any support for it, a discussion. Okay. I see four. I see five. I want a clean sweep. And even Dr. Valentine's supporting it. Just some a discussion of it. What our comfort level is, where we are, where some of these other districts are. I think they're in the information that we got in Friday packet. If you read over it again, I would like everyone to know that when I spoke to Tahoe Truckee, that they are holding a 3.5%, 3 or 3.5% reserve, but they're an outlier. They have been in a cut mode for a long period of time, continue to be in a cut mode, and so they're not. They're not there with us. And also, if you would change the number for Solana Beach from 3% to 8% in the information that you have, as per what I received from their superintendent today. Okay? So, thank you.
I would like to place supplementary instructional materials, board policy 6161.11, on a future agenda item to be discussed, to be adding films and videos in with what teachers can decide on their professional judgment.
I had a question. It sounds like that may come up in the study session regarding classroom. Would it help at all if we waited till after
the administration, if they were not already approved, whatever the approval process is?
I feel supportive of it, but I want to wait till the study session to formalize it.
Okay.
That's my feel.
Okay, anything else?
Qualified.
Yeah,
wait till the study
session. All right, good. Anything else? Okay, let's move on to item number 22. Reports by board members and district administrators. Anyone? Mrs. Dickinson.
Gary Lamprecht, holiday concert. I want to call it the Christmas concert, of course, but the holiday concert. Spectacular. This was his last one, you guys. Mm-hmm. I'm going to rub it in that you missed it. I was the only board member there. And I saw all these emails when I got home because I wanted to email him, and they're all about attending the Morro Bay Assembly. But to me, that was not as important. It's Gary Lamprecht's concert. It was spectacular. That guy's a genius. And he has influenced a whole generation of people in a very, you know, profound way. So I congratulate him. And I was thrilled to be there. Dr. Valentine was there. Dr. Matakovich was there. Yeah.
Okay, other reports. Well, I went to the Morro Bay and Los Osos Band and Choir concerts on the Monday and Thursday night, so I missed those. But I did want to say that on Tuesday night, I went to the La Posadas that was at Del Mar. And I'm just going to say it was an amazing show of support by the community for the school and of the school for the community. There were at least 200 people there, families of all stripe and Hispanic and non-Hispanic families, lots of food, lots of excitement from the community of Morro Bay, and really I felt
helped bring people of different cultures together, and I would like to congratulate Del Mar Elementary School for that. Anything else? Shall we stand adjourned?
Make a motion to adjourn.
Let's adjourn.